This weekend starts right after this.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, Geico makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. Geico.com. Easy.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Neurological symptoms of COVID. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
A new study finds people who recover from a mild case of COVID may eventually experience brain fog, tingling, and blurred vision weeks later.
On the tech front, non-fungible tokens are the hottest thing in collectibles. We'll explain what they are.
A Pennsylvania woman on a solo hike of the entire Appalachian Trail has been motivated by two brushes with death. We'll have her story.
And why the college admissions process is getting crazier than ever.
This year, because of the pandemic, many high school students couldn't sit for the exams. So about 1,600 colleges and universities are now test optional, and about 600 of them just made that move since the pandemic began.
Melissa Korn at the Wall Street Journal on how the pandemic could change who gets into college. Few people on Earth have been tested for COVID-19 more than LeBron James or Tom Brady, each estimated at better than 200 times each. And something unexpected happened as the NBA and NFL poured money into protecting their business. They became an essential part of the scientific process. One of the more remarkable things about COVID-19 findings is how many of them come from sports. It's a story by Louise Radnofsky, sports reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Louise, take us through this.
Well, as people probably remember very vividly, the NBA drew a lot of attention right from the outset at the testing resources it was able to command at the time, testing resources that were very scarce for members of the general public. There was a lot of envy. There was a lot of resentment, particularly as in order to play through the pandemic in subsequent seasons and setups like the bubble, the NBA just used tens of thousands of tests. The NFL subsequently used even more. They also threw massive resources at screening their players for heart damage and massive resources at contact tracing. But all of this money that was spent, that people wondered, well, why can't I have that, did have one benefit for everybody, and that is that the scientific findings that came out of people who were able to study these seasons, which almost provided the ideal conditions for an experiment, particularly in the NBA bubble, because you had a closed environment with a defined population who were being tested up to three times a day at various points, really allowed you to run essentially an experiment or have the ideal conditions for an experiment. So they were able to find out a lot about COVID. And we, in looking back on the past year, realized that a lot of what we know about COVID, we know through sports.
That's remarkable. Did you say somebody like LeBron James may have been tested as many as 300 times?
It was a lot of testing, particularly in the NBA, which we think probably was not only the most tested league in sports, but possibly the most tested institution on the planet. I would welcome hearing from anybody who can imagine a more tested environment. But really, sports stands out to us for how much they did throw into attempting to keep their seasons going.
Jeez. All right. So what did we learn data-wise that seems so critical?
We've had a lot of real-world examples come out of sports. We know, for example, that the definition of close contact for the purposes of being exposed to COVID is no longer were you within 6 feet of an infected person for 15 minutes or more. 15 minutes went out the window. That was thanks to an NFL contact tracing study. We know most recently, perhaps, from a study of six sports leagues that the prospect of hidden heart damage, myocarditis kind of inflammation, is actually very rare. We know this because 789 players across these leagues were screened for such damage. Five of them had it. They sat out. The good news for the rest of the population is that cardiologists don't think that recreational athletes need to sit out in the same way. We have a sense of the prevalence of that. Right at the very beginning, sports gave us a vivid description of something that we now understand to be true, that COVID can be spread by people who don't have any symptoms of the disease themselves, may not even know that they have it. So asymptomatic spread was another finding that came from sports. We learned from the NFL that eating in general, also meeting and greeting, can be some of the riskiest activities in terms of transmission. Well less than 15 minutes required there for transmission to occur. Again, that came through an NFL study. Sports also contributed to the creation of tests. The NBA helped provide the data that supported a finding that spit was a reliable way to test for COVID-19. So there's really just off the top of my head, five big findings. Jeez, but, right. But we've seen this just come throughout sports all through the year.
We're speaking with Louise Radnovsky, sports reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Her story is called Scientists Needed Help Against COVID-19. They asked sports, and she's profiled the NBA and the NFL in terms of how they managed all this. You said, too, the NBA actually helped invent some of the testing?
They did. There were scientists at Yale who wanted to establish whether spit was a reliable method for detecting the presence of coronavirus. And they needed people who were being tested using the, at the time, more traditional method to compare the spit test against. You would be very hard-pressed to find a stable population who are being tested every single day whose tests you could then compare to the spit test to establish which set of tests is more accurate outside of sports, where, again, particularly in the NBA bubble at the time, you had access to people. People were not coming into contact with other people. Outside of the bubble, they were there, and they were tested. And they were being tested, and the NBA was willing to partner with researchers who wanted to try and establish this point that became very helpful for everybody.
That's Louise Radnovsky, sports reporter at the Wall Street Journal. As a business owner, you eventually realize you can't do everything yourself, but hiring is complicated. And what if you only need part-time help? Belay, an innovative staffing solution, has successfully matched thousands of businesses with part-time virtual assistants, bookkeepers, and social media strategists. Belay offers you a virtual support team that can transform your workday. Let Belay help you juggle less and accomplish more. Just go to Belay, B-E-L-A-Y, solutions.com/deal. That's BelaySolutions.com/deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. A new study is focusing on the long-term neurological symptoms in people who were never physically sick enough from COVID-19 to need hospitalization. The study of 100 patients from 21 states was published last Tuesday in the Annals of Clinical and Translational Neurology. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
They had mild COVID, then serious symptoms kicked in. Pam Bellick, health and science writer for the New York Times, talked to some of these folks and joins us now. Pam, what is happening to some of these people?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. There are really a lot of people who have had very mild experiences with, like, the initial COVID infection. They didn't have to go to the hospital. Often they only had, you know, a headache or a slight fever. And then weeks later, they end up with what we're coming to know as long COVID symptoms, often neurological issues like brain fog and tingling and tremors and things like that that can be really debilitating and interrupt, you know, the ability of people to go back to work, to concentrate, to just kind of return to their normal lives.
Do we have any kind of statistics as to how prevalent this might be?
We don't have, you know, kind of an overarching percentage, but we're starting to get more and more data. What I wrote about was a kind of the first study that looked at the people who were showing up at a clinic that was set up specifically for neurological problems in COVID patients who had, you know, post-COVID neurological issues. And so they looked at 100 patients. And the interesting thing, this doesn't tell you how many people have it, but it does give you a snapshot of what they are experiencing. And what they found is that 85% of those folks had four or more neurological issues, very, you know, kind of complex interwoven symptoms. It's not just one thing. And a lot of them also had, you know, physical problems like fatigue, and some had depression, some were struggling with shortness of breath. So there's a lot of, you know, kind of layers of this long COVID problem that is both physical and neurological and in some cases emotional for people, and it makes it very difficult for people to recover in any sort of straight line. And in fact, a lot of people end up having, you know, kind of clusters of symptoms that emerge and then go away and fluctuate. And so that's the problem that we're dealing with, and it's probably going to go on for a long time.
We're speaking with Pam Belek, health and science writer for the New York Times. Pam, do researchers or scientists have any idea why this is happening to certain people? Is there some commonality with these folks?
It's a really good question. They don't know the answer. You know, are some people more predisposed for one reason or another? They don't know. And it's not, you know, there's no easy way to figure it out, right? These are people who are often previously healthy. They're not the, you know, the elderly or the people with sort of pre-existing conditions who are most vulnerable to kind of the early assault of COVID infection that we've come to know. And so it's very hard to tell. It does seem like women are more commonly showing up at post-COVID clinics, but that could be that, you know, women in this still relatively early phase are maybe more likely to seek help. And we also are not seeing a really representative look at communities of color here, and that probably has a lot to do with, you know, access to health care, and maybe even that, you know, people in communities of color are getting some of their symptoms dismissed by doctors or not taken seriously. So there's a lot of work to be done to, you know, kind of reach out to people who are experiencing these things, and that will end up giving us a better picture of, you know, how widespread it is, who's most likely to be affected, how long it will go on for different people, what helps people recover, all of those things that are still a big question mark.
That's Pam Bullock, health writer at the New York Times, with this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
When you call a Dell Technologies advisor, you're talking to someone who isn't waiting for their turn to speak, but who actually wants to hear what you have to say. They're focused on you, ready to give advice on everything from laptops to the cloud, and offer tailored solutions powered by Intel vPro platform to keep your small business ready for what's next. Our advisors listen, so you know your small business needs have been heard. Call a Dell Technologies advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL.
Innovation, resilience, agility. It's how Michigan businesses work together and continue to build the future. Our expertise, talented workforce, and collaborative environment are making a difference now and shaping the future. Join us and make your mark where it matters. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to put your plans in motion. That's michiganbusiness.org/radio.
It's time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by Indeed. Indeed believes less is more. Indeed's Instant Match instantly searches its database of millions of resumes, delivering candidates who best fit your job description. More at indeed.com/credit. Non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, digital collectibles that are authenticated or minted using blockchain technology and purchased with cryptocurrencies, have burst into the worlds of art, sports, and even sneakers. But what exactly are they beyond that definition? In-depth analysis from Rob Enderle, founder of the tech advisory firm The Enderle Group. Rob, start with the basics.
Well, an NFT is a non-fungible token. It doesn't give you any rights to ownership, but there is only one token applied to any particular thing. And so because that kind of implies that there's a scarcity of them. For instance, if you had a non-fungible token to a Pokemon card, which was in the article, to that card, you're the only one that has the non-fungible token. And then you can trade it much like you would trade the card, except you don't have the card. To me, this smells like a Ponzi scheme. Because there is no fundamental value to these tokens. The only value they have is what is placed upon them by people trading them. It's not like a stock where you own a part of a company,
yeah,
or an actual card where you own something physical. This is all digital. It doesn't impart any rights other than the right to control that token. So you don't control the card. You don't control the unique piece of art. You don't own anything tangible other than this intangible token, which is uniquely yours and applied to the art. But these things have sold upwards of, I think, $1.8 million is the most expensive one that's been sold so far. And the total market right now is she's $250 million in sales. I take that back. One piece of art went for $69.3 million at auction. But you're not getting the art. You're just getting the token for the art, which didn't even exist often when the token came up. This is a spin out of cyber currency. It uses blockchain. But instead of investing in a cyber currency, you're investing in a token, which can go up or down based on how people bid for it. And as we've certainly seen in the market recently with GameStop, folks go a little crazy now when they're given the opportunity to bid up properties that have no inherent value. Yeah. So this is one of the things that I personally going to watch from the sidelines. Because I'm convinced this is going to play out like a Ponzi scheme, where whoever is left standing at the end is going to lose a ton of money.
Oh, wow.
Once people realize these things have no inherent value,
I can't even fully grasp what it is. You reference this art piece that sold for like $69 million. It's a piece of digital art, and
right.
You own the token. You don't actually
you don't own the art.
So I'm not going to walk into your house and say, "Well, that is a beautiful painting," because I can't even see it or touch it.
No, say you had a token to a piece of famous art. You don't have the art. I mean, you could have a picture of the art, but you could have the picture of the art without the token. And so you've got what, bragging rights that you paid $69.3 million for a token? I mean, I'm just struggling with all the other stuff you could do with $69.3 million and buying a piece of. What? something that I don't know. I'm struggling with this one a lot. Of course, I've struggled with digital currency for much the same reason, because no government backs it up yet.
Yeah.
So that may change. My sense on digital currency is as soon as a major government starts issuing their own digital currency, a lot of this stuff is going to evaporate, because then at least you have a government and regulation suggesting that there is some base value that it could still carry. But these non-fungible tokens, it just seems like insanity to me it really looks like a scam at colossal proportions, and that at some point the market's going to catch on to the fact that there's really nothing there, and the market will correct it. It'll correct rather catastrophically.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, founder of the Enderle Group. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. In the sport of business, we're all players, and with the game always changing, you need to be versatile. So does your wardrobe. You want both style and comfort to look as good as you feel inside the office or out. That's what Cuts Clothing is all about. Cuts Clothing keeps you sharp wherever the game takes you, from the boardroom to the bar to the gym. How? They reinvented men's clothing, starting with the t-shirt. Their Pika Tri-Blend fabric is buttery soft, wrinkle-free, and keeps its shape. Everything I've worn from Cuts is next-level comfort. Their polos, hoodies, and crew sweatshirts, all classics, made modern with custom-engineered fabrics you have to wear to believe. So versatile, you'll never need to take them off, and so comfortable, you won't want to. It's not just the lifestyle. It's not just clothing. It's office leisure apparel for the sport of business. Get 15% off your first order by going to cutsclothing.com/Gordon. That's cutsclothing.com/Gordon for 15% off the only shirt worth wearing. Well, Ivy League schools and a host of other highly selective institutions waived SAT and ACT requirements for the class of 2025, resulting in an unprecedented flood of applications and what may prove the most chaotic selection experiment in American higher education since the end of World War II. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
The college admissions season is always a stressful time. This time around, though, it's going to be crazier than ever. Melissa Korn of the Wall Street Journal has taken a look at what's going on and joins us now. Melissa, first of all, what's changed with regard to the SATs and ACTs this year?
Pretty much everything. This year, because of the pandemic, many high school students couldn't sit for the exams. So about 1,600 colleges and universities are now test optional, and about 600 of them just made that move since the pandemic began. So you're not required to submit an SAT or ACT score to many, many colleges to be considered for admission. And that's a really big shift. Many of these schools really paid attention to those test scores as they were figuring out who to admit before.
What might schools look at more or less in lieu of those test scores?
Yeah, so they've always looked at a range of things, right? They call it holistic admissions. And now high school grades, the rigor of someone's coursework, you know, whether they took advanced placement courses and exams, that all matters more. Extracurricular activities, which again, there's a challenge there because so many were canceled this past year. Teacher recommendations, personal statements, all the other elements of the application matter just a little bit more to fill the gap of that one data point that they don't have anymore.
What will schools do when comparing a student who has turned in their scores optionally and someone who hasn't?
So, right, the schools say that they will consider those two applications equally, right? If somebody has fantastic grades and strong extracurriculars, they show leadership, they have glowing recommendations, and they don't have a test score, they'll be considered quite seriously for a spot at that school. If somebody submits a test score, but the rest of their credentials kind of don't stack up, then that test score alone isn't enough to get them in.
We're speaking with Melissa Korn of the Wall Street Journal. Melissa, in general terms, what do applicants look like? Not applicants, but how many applicants are there this year?
So the number of applicants hasn't changed dramatically. What has changed is the number of applications. So the same number of high school seniors are putting in to kind of try to get into many more schools. So we saw application volume jump by 20, 30, even 40% at some of the most selective schools in the country, which means that their acceptance rates, already in the single digits and low teens, will now be even lower this year, which is astonishing and heartbreaking for so many of those seniors who are waiting for their admissions decisions, just because there will be so many rejection letters.
What about the students who deferred enrollment during the pandemic?
Yeah, a number of students did decide to delay the start of their college years, and they may begin this fall. Some may have decided to take a different path, go to a different school instead, or stay closer to home. So not everyone who deferred will actually show up, but for some schools, they do take a portion of the freshman spots. Some schools have said that they will still take the same number of first-year students as they normally would, because overall they want their student body to stay the same size. Others, you know, there's only so many dorm rooms for first students on campus, so they have to take that into account when they're deciding how big their new admitted class should be.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Melissa Korn.
When you call a Dell Technologies advisor, you're talking to someone who isn't waiting for their turn to speak, but who actually wants to hear what you have to say. They're focused on you, ready to give advice on everything from laptops to the cloud, and offer tailored solutions powered by Intel vPro platform to keep your small business ready for what's next. Our advisors listen, so you know your small business needs have been heard. Call a Dell Technologies advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL.
Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. This portion of the program is brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. Our financial markets in a bubble. You may have heard people fret that there's a bubble in Bitcoin or special purpose acquisition companies known as SPACs, maybe Tesla, maybe the entire U.S. stock market. Should we be looking to get out of harm's way right now? In-depth analysis from Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, how do you see it?
Well, there's a lot of anxiety among investors right now, and with good reason. I mean, we've seen some pretty crazy things going on in the financial markets. You think about the meteoric rise of Tesla. You think about the craziness over GameStop and those short-selling hedge funds. You think about Bitcoin. I mean, that's been pretty nuts, about special purpose acquisition companies. If we get it all together, and one of the things that I hear over and over again is that the markets are in a financial bubble. But the question I try to address with this particular article is that really the case? And at least to me, it's not clear.
Mm. Is it ever clear?
To some extent, it is. I mean, if you think back over the past 40 years or so, there were certain times when it seemed like particular markets were out of touch with reality. And it wasn't just that we saw this in retrospect. A lot of people at the time were saying that. And what I'm referring to here is what was going on with Japanese stocks and real estate in the late 1980s. What was going on with tech stocks in the late 1990s. What was happening with the housing market, not just here in the U.S., but around the world during the mid-2000s. A lot of people declared that there was a bubble in these assets, and yet, in their enthusiasm, other investors ignored those warnings and went ahead and bought, and of course, they suffered dearly for their exuberance. And to some degree, when we think about bubbles, there are certain markets that we can look for, and each of those bubbles met those various criteria.
Mm. All right, so you looked at, in a new book, kind of these the criteria for some of these financial bubbles. Take us through a couple of them.
So, yeah, the book in question is called The Delusions of Crowds, and it's written by a guy called Bill Bernstein, who's actually a friend and also a fellow author. And Bill, drawing on the work of an economist called Hyman Minsky, notes that there are four conditions necessary for a financial bubble to form. One, easy credit, i.e. really low interest rates, which is what we've got today. Exciting new technologies. Again, we have that today in part with things like electric cars and the blockchain technology. We have amnesia about the prior bubble and bust. And that one isn't quite so clear. And then we also have the abandonment of old prudent methods for valuing investments. So, for instance, today, you know, a lot of people will make excuses for the valuations put on stock. Mm-hmm. They'll say we shouldn't be that concerned about the high PE ratios. And in the case of certain investments like Bitcoin, I don't know how you value that.
Right. We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. And he's written about whether or not financial markets are in a bubble. So when you look at these different criteria, it may still be uncertain, but is anybody saying that, you know, that we should get out of harm's way?
When it comes to certain investments, yes, people are saying, let's get out of harm's way. We're talking about things like Bitcoin. We're talking about things like GameStop. I'd also refer to, you know, the Robinhood phenomenon, all these people day trading stocks. That's clearly not a sensible strategy for building long-term wealth. But is the entire financial market about to come crashing down? I would argue that is not the case. In the past 10 years, yeah, we've seen huge gains by high-flying growth stocks, you know, the Amazon, Apple, Googles of this world. But the other half of the U.S. stock market, value stocks, have struggled over the past decade.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements from HumbleDollar.com. See if this describes you. During this year of pandemic stress, the American Dental Association says that dental health is a casualty. An ADA survey found more than 70% of dentists report an issue of patients with teeth grinding and clenching problems, conditions often associated with stress. More from James Causey, columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. James, what's up here?
Well, it's amazing. A real short story. It happened to me, and that's how I discovered the story. I was eating pizza at home, a homemade pizza, and bit down, and I chipped my tooth. And I went to the dentist, got an emergency appointment, and I went in, and he said, James, this is not unusual. A lot of people are chipping their teeth. And grind as a result of grinding and clenching their teeth brought on by stress. And I didn't realize how much I was actually grinding my teeth at night. And so that's how I discovered the story. So basically what it comes down to this, you know, our bodies try to deal with stress in a lot of different ways. And, you know, the pandemic has been hard on all of us, right? So a lot of us are just trying to hold so much in. So we're clenching our teeth during the day. And a lot of us are grinding our teeth at night. And it doesn't have to be for long periods of time, but that's a lot of pressure on our teeth. Mm. And that's causing the chipping and the cracking.
Yeah, I was going to say, who chips their tooth biting something soft like pizza? But as you probably experienced, I guess, you had weakened that tooth over time.
Yeah. And what dentists are seeing is that usually if it's a tooth that had a filling in it, you know, over time, you know, that constant clenching and grinding, it just wears around it. The filling doesn't crack, but the tooth around it cracks, and a lot of people are cracking all kinds of things. So it's amazing how this is happening.
So did you know, or were you in denial and say, I don't clench my teeth or grind at night, or were you aware that you were doing it?
I had no idea, and that's what a lot of people are experiencing. Wow. when they actually come into the dentist, they have no idea that they grind their teeth, but only dentists could see like the wear on your teeth over time. When you go in for an appointment, they usually are the first to alert you to it, or you know, your partner at night, because they can hear it. Because most of the time, nobody knows, and because you don't realize it, it goes on undetected for a long periods of time, months, sometimes years.
Wow. We're speaking with James Causey, columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, part of the USA Today Network. He's got an important story called A Silent Byproduct of the Pandemic. Stress is causing a spike in chipped and cracked teeth. How common has this become?
Well, it's really picked up a lot. Basically, the American Dental Association did a study, and what they discovered, like pre-pandemic, it was like less than 40-50% of the people grind and clench their teeth. And what they discovered is like during the pandemic, when the pandemic started, it just really spiked up. Several dentist offices are reporting up to a 50% increase in chipped and cracked teeth.
Wow.
And one thing that they're doing to remedy this is prescribing mouth guards. And, you think of a mouth guard, like who would want to wear that at night? But yeah, it could really save on the wear and tear on your teeth.
Wow. My wife wears one for like just a couple of bottom teeth in the front. That's it. But there are, I guess you can wear a full mouth one covering your tops or bottoms or both.
Yeah. And the thing is, they range in price. You could buy a cheap one at like a sporting goods store for like 12 to 20 bucks. You know, you don't get the right kind of fit with that.
Yeah.
Or you could pay up to $500 for one that's made at the dentist's office, and they could get pricey, but it's worth it, because if you don't get it done, guess what? If you chip a tooth, you're looking at up to $1,000 to get that fixed.
That's James Causey, columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Coming up next, what motivated a woman to hike the Appalachian Trail solo?
Innovation. Resilience. Agility. It's how Michigan businesses work together and continue to build the future. Our expertise, talented workforce, and collaborative environment are making a difference now and shaping the future. Join us and make your mark where it matters. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to put your plans in motion. That's michiganbusiness.org/radio.
We'll finish with this. How about this for motivation? A woman from Northeast Pennsylvania on Friday left her husband, her dog, her cat, and her job to begin the 2,190-mile solo trek of the Appalachian Trail that will start in Georgia and end in Maine. Gwen Buchanan, who's 51, says while her motivation has evolved over the years, her clear, unwavering version of herself, embracing the joys and challenges of the journey, has gotten her through some of her toughest moments. NextAvenue.org says the physical therapist from Mahoopnee is referring to two accidents that nearly took her life. In total, she's been through rehab four times, once for each accident and again following separate bilateral hip surgeries. Though she recovered from her injuries, her accidents left her with pelvic imbalances that ultimately required joint replacements, yet she never lost sight of her dream of hiking the entire Appalachian Trail. She's taken multi-day backpacking trips whenever possible and started running marathons, primarily to build endurance for the six-month journey. A GPS device will keep her husband always apprised of her location, plus it has an SOS button she can press to activate a response if needed from the nearest emergency center. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, GEICO makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. GEICO.com. Easy.